Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. My name's Pip Adam. I had to remember my name for a minute there. This is episode 126. It is the 14th in our series Beyond a Joke. And in this episode, I get to talk to James Nokise. It's just so great to talk to James. We are talking about the Verb After Hours Beyond a Joke event. James was kind enough to be part of that. And it was an incredible night. And James's bit, I still don't know what you call these little bits. It was like, yeah, this performance that he gave was particularly, poignant and wonderful and fantastic and funny, which I'm very grateful for. So we spend some time talking about that and all sorts of other things. James is incredibly busy. His podcast, Fair Game Pacific Rugby Against the World, which he made with John Darnielle, it's a stunning, stunning, stunning piece of work. And we talk a little bit about that. It's an incredible, incredible podcast. I just really love it. And even if, like, perhaps you have been thinking that you won't listen to it because it's about rugby, it's about so much more than rugby. And I just think everybody should listen to it. It's really great. James is also, he's been performing in Aotearoa and Australia. And you are lucky because James is in the Southern Hemisphere for a little bit longer and you can catch him at the New Zealand International Comedy Festival. I think his event, I should have looked this up, but he is performing a show which is called Right About Now, which is will put an earworm in your ear, but also is very interesting. We talk a little bit about where we should be up to and where we're not up to in this episode. So thank you again for listening. Thank you to the Substack subscribers. I really appreciate it. Whether you pay or not, I really appreciate it. The notice that you pay is great, and I'm also, obviously, I'm extremely grateful for the money that comes in. It helps me pay everybody and get this stuff done. So yeah, thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
Oh man, we are so lucky. Imagine like being able to come out and see amazing people all night and just, yeah, blows my mind sometimes. Hi James. James might, I don't want to throw you, but you might tell us a little bit about your amazing new podcast. James Nokise.
Hi. It's a podcast about rugby, so I don't know how I'm going to... Well, it's me. So it's a podcast about rugby, but it's about the way in which world rugby has been exploiting Pacific nations for the last 30 years. So really, it's about money, which is what I want to talk to you guys about, because I'm overseas as much as the apocalypse allows me to be. And when you are overseas, it gives you a certain perspective, particularly on New Zealand and all the stresses that New Zealand likes to think of big things, and they're not. And... for instance, we've had wonderful performances. Gabby has presented the sequel to The Sound of Music none of us knew that we wanted. Ema has spoken to one of the great pieces, arguably, of fringe art that Newtown's ever produced. And Joe just did, like, as someone with a Samoan dad who definitely keeps secrets between me and my siblings, like, that's when you realize your parents just love keeping secrets. And each of you as a sibling holds a secret that you will only find out at the parents' death. Like, that really spoke to me. I loved it. I'm definitely winging this, but I'm only being paid, how much?
$180.
$180 before tax?
I'm unsure of taxable deductions, but I imagine it's before tax.
So really, for $25, you're getting what it's worth. And that's kind of my point. Last week I headlined a Wellington Comedy Club, sold it out, got paid $300. And that's not much. It's $300 New Zealand. It does fuck all in the world economy. And I write a fortnightly column for Stuff, fortnightly because I'm a New Zealand columnist, and it's just not enough to fill a week after week. All of the weekly columnists are like 15 to 20 years older than me because they've got enough life experience to fill in the gaps with their own stuff. Whereas I just pop up once every 2 weeks and go, hey, New Zealand, what do you think about Tuvalu? And New Zealand goes, fat Tuvalu. And I go, oh, I'm going to need a week to recover from that. So, and they pay me $220 in the hand for just an insane amount of racial abuse. Radio New Zealand pays even less to write a column for them. I'll get about $160 in the hand. And some of you might be going, that's quite a bit. And that's because you are not affected very much by the cost of living crisis. Because that's the thing. It isn't. It's an embarrassingly poor amount. And every writer in this festival gets bugger all cash. And we're making a big kerfuffle in this country right now about how much arts is funded by the government. But the reason it needs to be funded by the government is that we as a New Zealand society have decided collectively, unconsciously, to not pay for the arts ourselves. You pay $25. $25 to see some of the best talent this city has ever produced. For $25, we're worth more than that. We're worth way, and you know this. But we've collected, and that's part of to do with funding as well. But it's like, if I told you what I earned for the work I do, the exact same work I do in New Zealand, writing columns, podcasts, stand-up comedy, what I get paid in Australia, what I get paid in the United States, what I get paid in the UK, you would feel embarrassed for them. Because you'd be like, well, wait a second, do they know they're getting scammed by this New Zealand artist for being paid definitely too much? Four figures? It's just writing about Tuvalu, for God's sake. And that's the thing, is that we need to change our mindset. And you might be going, this is quite serious. No, it's very funny. It makes me giggle so much because I'll be stressing out sitting in another country about how people are going to feel about my column about the All Blacks being vulnerable to losing to Argentina and accidentally becoming the only journalist in New Zealand to pick Argentina winning because I thought it was funny. And I'll be stressing and stressing. And then my wife will go, honey, it's 80 quid. And you go, oh, yeah. Why am I reading the comment section? And I think we're not going to be able to see a proper engagement with the arts from the government until we as a society realize we don't value our artists because we constantly complain about how expensive stuff is, and yet we don't go and support them if it's over a certain price. And yet there's cost of living, there's other things, but you'll save up for things. You eat noodles and toast, as you learned back in the day, to pay for a ticket to go see something international, but you don't value it because it's from New Zealand. And I think that's funny. And I know that that's maybe not funny to some of you, but that's the difference between your mind and the mind of a comedian. We're very broken people. And we have slightly dark takes on the world. But it's the absurdity that makes me giggle. And I think I better shut up because there's a thin line between a funny chat and a sermon. And normally it's when I pass out the hat after my talk for you to give an offering to the writers. But I guess that's the thing, is that don't forget in all of the big kerfuffle that's been happening in the arts community that when people are like, yes, money's important, yes, money helps us live, but it's not going to change while we all decide to not shift what we think the bottom line, the least we're prepared to pay for something is. That's my thoughts.
Hello, James. How are you?
I'm good, Pip. Hello.
We're sitting in the studio at Wellington Access Radio. It feels very profesh.
As professional as it ever does down here at Access.
It's the Wild West of broadcasting. Thank you so much for coming along today. I really appreciate it. I've been looking forward to talking to you about your amazing performance last year. And it's been so wonderful having you around. Thank you for that. And I wonder, before I get too far ahead of myself, if you would be willing to introduce yourself however you want to do that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, my name's James Nokise, and I am a comedian, writer. Technically, I'm a podcaster. I don't have a, like, a podcast that keeps going. I do series of podcasts on subject matters. So, financially, I'm a podcaster. I guess in the modern times, my pronouns are he, him. Very, very outdated in the Wellington scene. But I am of immigrant parents. My mother is from Wales, and my father is from Samoa. And I grew up in Wellington, and so I'm a Kiwi.
Oh man, it's so great to have you here. This is for my own interest. What part of Samoa do you come from? Do you know?
All Samoans, I have two villages. So in Upolu, which is the Long Island, the village is Lusoli, which is a small village on the north coast, which is about 20-25 minutes east of Apia.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Savai, it's Whangaupo. And Whangaupo is quite a well-known village in Savai. It's on the northeast coast. There's a few famous people from there, Manu Tuolangi in rugby, in the arts, just a not well-known comedian also called Rose Matafeo.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
and we didn't know we were cousins for the longest time, and I'm definitely more proud of that than she is. but we didn't know we were cousins, and then she sent me this wonderful photo, which I saved, of our two grandfathers and the other four cousins sitting together for a group photo in Whangaupo, and just with the caption, "Holy shit."
Related. Oh, my God, that's so cool. Oh, Savai, it's one of my favorite places in the whole wide world. I just love it there so much. It actually, I'm going on a tangent. It started me thinking about New Animals. That was where I started thinking about that novel was there. It's I just love it there so much. It's so great. Okay, so I normally ask people to choose what they talk about, but I didn't give you any choice whatsoever. I asked if we could talk about the performance that you gave at the Verb After Hours, and I wonder if you could start by describing that, however you want to describe it.
I believe the brief that you gave us for that Verb performance was just something you find funny, which is quite a strange question for a comedian to get. I know it doesn't sound odd, but I don't know how many comedians, I know you know a few, but we're all weirdly intense. Like anyone who knows comedians knows that we're all like ironically quite serious. There's only a few properly natural comedians on and off stage I've ever met. People like, I have never met Robin Williams, but he was like that. Same with Billy Connolly, Tofinga Fupuliai. People who are very similar to how they are on stage, they're on stage just slightly heightened. But a lot of comics are actually quite deadpan, like serious, think about their craft. And you got to be careful. So when you get to, what does something you find funny, go, oh my God, what do I find funny? And suddenly you're just like 2 hours goes past and you've just got like a pad and a pen in front of you just staring at, like you're Edgar Allan Poe trying to compose a joke or something. I think maybe it's just a combination of the times, but I was just putting budgets together. It's the time of year, and I was putting festival budgets together and looking at stuff, and I thought, oh, it's quite funny because I write these columns for Stuff and for other publications, and I do these podcasts, and I do stand up and I appear on galas. There's quite a bit of me online, and I get quite a bit of hate from people who disagree with the topics the way I'm talking about them. And it's funny because the defense of that you always get is, yeah, but, if you didn't want that, you wouldn't put yourself out there and you get paid, a professional athlete, you get paid. And I was like, oh, no, not not NBA players. New Zealand comedian. That's like a parallel universe away from the kind of pay to get the abuse. And I thought, it's very funny to me how stressed out I get as someone who tours overseas about like New Zealand jobs because it pays so little. But also how funny people think I get paid so much because they're quite public jobs, but I don't. And I realize people don't really talk about that. And so part of the joke for me is people not knowing how much we get paid. So I think I emailed you and said, could I talk about how much we get paid? Like, which, again, writing the email, you go, oh, I hope she doesn't think I'm being a dick about how much she's paying me for this gig. But, I wanted to talk about, when we talk about the arts being unfunded or we talk about, you know, struggling artists, like the realities of what pay actually looks like, because in New Zealand I am within the comedy community a senior artist. I've won almost all the awards. I'm council young comics at the request of New Zealand Comedy Trust. I'm considered one of the top senior live comedians, at least. And I don't make very much money in New Zealand. And I think that's quite funny, because you get a lot of people coming at you. So, yeah, that's what I ended up talking about.
And, like, of course, I was on fire with this idea. Like, I've been writing recently about this idea that, I think people have this need for... you know, this need to not know how much artists are paid. You know, like, I think that we have this myth around the artist being outside society, you know, like it's sort of a calling, you know, like, you know, it's a calling. You know, I don't know how you're supposed to pay for your food with a calling. But, yeah, so I was very interested in your take on this. And I think one of the things I was interested in was how well developed it was by the time you got on stage. Like, there's one thing to just stand up and rant about these things, and I love a rant. I'm never, ever putting down a rant. But there was something really well developed about it, and I just wonder, was it completely off the cuff by the time you got on the stage? Was it something that you'd thought about? Do you write notes down? Do you, like, talk to yourself in the shower? Like, how, yeah, like, what does it look like when you're trying to develop something like that?
Well, first of all, I always talk to myself in the shower.
Yes, and I think it's vitally important.
It's absolutely.
No one else.
Some people sing. I think comedians talk to themselves in the shower. I eat chicken in the shower occasionally when I'm depressed.
Yes, well, so true.
Anyone who knows my podcast will know. I didn't make notes. I didn't necessarily wing it. I did, in terms of, I listened to everyone else and I looked at the crowd and I saw their response. I think I was the fourth speaker up there. Yeah. I think I referenced that at the beginning, like saying, what a nice night we've had. We've had this person talk. So in that sense, I adjusted my tone and what I was going to talk to, because I think, as I also said in the speech, you don't want to sermonize.
Yeah.
You want to engage and get them engaged. You know, what you're saying resonates. The fact is that one of the results of the pandemic, I've found, at least in the Western countries where stand-up comedy is happening, is we have been having discussions about class. Because we're all in the artistic struggle, but when the pandemic happened and our live performing work was decimated, evaporated, as I would say to friends. Suddenly, you know, backs against the wall. Everyone's got nothing. Turned out some people had families that had something, and you know, there was a divide that occurred. Particularly in the UK, in the UK scene, but also to lesser degrees in Australia and New Zealand. And that's really emphasized something that's been growing in the past, I would say, 15 to 20 years, and that is the gentrification of the arts from grassroots to exclusivity. Exclusivity?
Yeah, I like that. It sounds good.
So I drew on conversations I've been having with other working class performers across the world as we've been doing festivals. And these are just, you know, coffee and cake conversations. They're not like strategic meetings. It's like, hey, I know a wonderful friend of mine did a beautiful show on being a working class comic in Britain, and his brother got evicted just before Edinburgh, and he had to carry that weight into his work, but he made it so, and he just spent the last 5 minutes of the show was not funny. But the rest of the show had been funny, and the last five was just like an Daniel Blake, rant at the audience about how we have to talk about money.
Mm.
And there's been other performers who have just been saying, hey, you know, we can't stop this gentrification if we won't even admit that there are privilege and money in what is supposed, comedy is meant to be like the lower art form. But it's got all of these people coming in whose parents, you know, aren't even like rich. They like work for oil companies and so have stability, or then parents don't rent, you know, or there's just all of these advantages that when things go south, you know, so someone like me, I'm very privileged with my education. You know, my father came from a small village and got a university education. He's an associate professor and has, you know, all his academic titles. My mother was a post-war kid in Europe on rations, but ended up in the New Zealand public sector. They worked hard, but they divorced when I was four.
Mm.
So they elevated themselves individually, but there was no combined income. So my mum and me were still hiding from debt collectors because my dad wasn't paying child support because he works for the church. Not because the church says don't pay child support. He's just poor. There's no money. When both of them retire, I will be giving them money and I don't have that much. And I don't think that people understand that in the arts, there's a whole bunch of other people who will be a whiff nail and I, lushes, smoking and drinking and going, I can't smoke anymore. I can't afford it.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, I can't, thank God I'm an alcoholic. I couldn't afford the booze now.
Yeah.
It's that whole lifestyle. And again, this is what I mean about comedians. We're sort of, what a serious few minutes we've just had talking about stuff. But I find that funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's a bit grim, but I think it's really funny in a laugh or you cry kind of way.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that was one of the questions that I asked you on the night was like, is humor telling the truth? You know what I mean? Like, I feel like there are these layers and layers and layers of politeness on top of this truth, you know. I don't know, like, you know, like there's so much I could talk about there. Like just the idea that so many people, you know, if you want to make art, you're limited by money as well. You know, like the type of art that you make ends up being different, you know. And, yeah, just thinking about Avatar and things like that, you know, like I just think that and then, you know, I often think about Creative New Zealand as well. Like I just so want – it seems so vitally important that we have a really functioning, you know, I don't know, government-funded, you know, some way of making sure that it isn't just rich people with time that are able to make money, to make art. But just back to this idea about truth, like, do you think that humour often is just telling the truth?
Well, I think, I don't know if I mentioned that the formula is always tragedy plus time.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes that's where gallows humour comes in.
It's
a coping mechanism. I don't know if comedy is always telling the truth. I think telling is the key word there.
Yeah.
You know, I think comedy can reveal truths in the way a jester would back in the day. But I think truth-telling is a trap within social comedy for a lot of people, you know. You see a lot of young comics who they get to a certain point, they're talking about social commentary and they want to be, they discover all the old masters, you know, they discover Carlin, they discover Bill Hicks was such a trap when I was growing up, you know. To a degree, people like Louis C.K., you know, if you're just taking his behavior offstage to the side, a lot of young men especially wanted to say like the kind of nasty stuff he'd say without understanding where it came from, without 20 years of a bitter career with a bitter social life and harvesting that, they want to be 20 something and talking about their bitch of an ex and it's like, but no, you're 20, you got no, you don't have the life experience, you haven't even had your heart broken properly. How can you know that truth? So I think often the biggest laughs come from the catharsis that comedy can provide. But I think saying comedy is telling the truth is why, to a degree, I think comedy as a profession, like the world of comedy has is being quite combative at the moment. People are drawing up. We used to all just be comedians in a green room, and now it feels like everyone wants to be combative because they've got a truth that they have to put out there. And it's like, I mean, there's only one truth, guys. We're all fucked.
Yeah.
that's the truth.
Yeah.
Should have been a lawyer. That's the truth.
Because I think that's what's really interesting, like, because what I was going to ask you, and I haven't prepped you for it, so I thought I'd better not, but, like, we're sort of moving towards there. Like, when you said you don't want to sermonize, this is something that I really thought was friggin' amazing about that night watching you, is that there is a way of taking the audience with you, sure, but there's also a way of being willing to challenge them as well. And you seem, I don't know if you'd agree with this, but you seemed to be able to know when to be, because you do in that bit say, you all came here and didn't pay very much to come here. Mm. I'm not getting paid very much to be here. Mm. Why didn't you pay more? You know, like, I mean, you didn't say it like that. But I just wonder, like, how important is it to take them with you? But then, do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like that feels you were doing so much more than just taking them with you, if you know what I mean.
Well, this is the part where I say these are my views on comedy. Because comedy is subjective, and comedy is it's an art form, but it's also a craft.
Mm.
So there's certain things that we all do the same no matter what. But then there's divergence, and in that wonderful divergence is the individuality of different performers.
Yeah.
For myself, I think part of it is I come from a church background, so I've watched emotional manipulators for all my life.
Yeah.
I kind of know what it looks like. I'm I won't say cold papa because I don't like it. It is. It's what my brain reaches for because I grew up in New Zealand, but I'm not sure. I feel like it's too reverent a word for what I'm actually doing. I think the spirit of what I try and do with an audience, and this is from failing and learning, is I try and take their hand and I lead them and then I make sure I bring them back.
Right.
And
yeah,
I think the difference between, I've done theatre work in the past, the difference between my theatre work and my comedy work is the journey back. When I do theatre to hurt an audience, to let them understand pain, and so I leave them there. When I do comedy, I think part of the social contract between a comedian and an audience is entertainment and joy.
Mm.
And so I bring them back and I lead them back. So, and I think that I've been doing this long enough now that my audience, especially in New Zealand, but I think also in Edinburgh, there's that trust where, you know, first we get to reacquaint ourselves at the beginning of one of my shows, then I'll take their hand and then we're going to go in. But they know no matter where we go, we're going to come back out. And that's the simple flow, I think, of my work.
That's kind of blown my mind, as always, whenever I talk to you. that has completely blown my mind because, I was just thinking about that social contract. You know, it's such an interesting, you know, having been to sort of the comedy of dis-ease kind of shows as well, like, which is like, you know, I always, one of the problems I have with that is I always leave congratulating myself. You know what I mean? Like, I'm always like, oh, wow, that was amazing. You know, I'm woke and I'm able to, you know, deal with that. Whereas I think this idea of a leading in and leading out, you're left with, it just feels like there's more of you in that than there is. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just feels like it's more, I don't want to say the word collaborative, but it feels more, I don't know.
Comedy is, like, I think, an incredibly collaborative. They got to laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they don't laugh.
Yeah.
You're not really doing stand-up. That's why, one of the sayings in the industry is the joke isn't finished until it's on stage.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can, and I mean within stand-up, and to a degree within comedic theatre as well.
Yeah,
you know, you can write the funniest line in the world, and then when it's performed, maybe it's the performer or maybe it's actually the way it sounds when spoken, just doesn't fly.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the end, we're trying to make people laugh And we're trying to keep them engaged. Mm. And that's the difference between being a comedian and being another type of performer.
Mm.
And I think around the 10-year mark, I find for most stand-ups, they either stick or they pivot. Not out of the arts, but they'll go, what I'm getting from an audience isn't necessarily what I want to be getting from an audience. And what the audience is allowing me to do isn't necessarily what I want to be doing.
Mm. Oh, my gosh. I will probably get this wrong, and like because you're a practice comedian, but I just heard Mark Maron say a little while ago that, and I probably will get this wrong, but what I took from it was you can make a joke about anything you want to make a joke about, but the audience will be people that find that funny.
Mm.
So like this idea, it made me really interested because I think that that's something I notice, like standing up there and telling jokes. There's some jokes that are real low-hanging fruit that, you know what I mean? Like and I don't know where those laughs come from, but yeah, it's just interesting you saying this thing about kind of like developing the craft and making decisions about what the laughs are that you want to get.
But even then, like you can be in a live room and you see the low-hanging joke. Now you might, you know, decide that that's beneath you and you move on, or you might go for it, or you might go for it, get the quick laugh, cut off the audience's laugh, tell them that's low hanging fruit. We're better than that. There's so many different ways, even though you see the low hanging fruit joke, there's so many different ways you can play it. And there's not necessarily a correct way because, you might be going, well, just getting the low hanging joke and moving on isn't the right way. But what's the crowd?
Yeah.
Who are you playing to?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you don't want to patronize them.
No.
You know, but you also want to go, okay, guys, this isn't. Yeah, it depends also on how you're feeling, how invested you are in it. You might not be getting paid much and see the low-hanging thing, boom, they got to laugh, all right, let's get out of here.
I was funny because I was listening to a comedian the other day who was saying that there was jokes that they put early on in their set, and if they get a laugh from that, they think, I'm not telling you, I'm not going deep about myself.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like if you think that's funny, I'm going on plan B, you know, and you know you don't get the heavy stuff. And I just think this is what continues to blow my mind about it, is that it looks like I stand up here, but it's so much about that audience read and that energy in the room. And you know, that's what I wondered. Like, I mean, you know, you've also made theatre, and I wonder, what is it about comedy that you feel like, I guess it's that boring question of why comedy, but what is it about it that gives you what you want, if you know what I mean?
It's the dialogue.
Yeah.
It's the ability to dialogue. But it's also the economics. It's the ability to travel, to meet new people, to understand where they're coming from, to grow, to be able to, you know, this job, when done rightly, opens incredible options for traveling, and they don't always pay great, but you get to go to strange places. You know, I've gigged in countries I wouldn't even have thought to have visited. At times of the day, I would feel irresponsible. But, you know, and I think that's when we talk about it being a lifestyle, you know, as a stand-up comic, I'm much more of a touring festival comedian. There's a whole bunch of, you know, different types, different styles, because it all takes time. You know, you mentioned time before. Time is the currency. You know, time is the great currency. And you got to figure out where you want to invest your time. I got some friends who are really fun social media comics. You know, I really like watching their stuff on TikTok, Instagram, and other friends who do YouTube. You know, they got into YouTube when they were making sketches and that. And they've taught me for it. You know, I do stuff on TikTok and Instagram sometimes for publicity or whatnot. And so they've showed me how to do it. And we've had some genuinely serious business talks about they get up and they work it like a 9-to-5. So I've done some of that to be able to know that I can make those kind of clips, that I know how to do it, and I've looked at the amount of investment that it takes, and I've gone, actually, I'm a comedian, I'm a writer, I'm a professional podcaster. I only have so many hours in the day. I have a family, you know, I have my own mental and physical health, which I need to take care of. So I don't think I can be a full-time TikTok comedian too. Or, you know, I don't think I can devote myself to sketches or whatnot. I don't think I can put myself forward for every panel show.
Yeah.
And that's no shade to any of that. It's, if anything, my mates are like, oh, thank you. oh, good.
Make some room.
Yeah. I show up on TV once or twice a year doing a gala, and that's enough racial abuse for me. And so,
God.
What are you talking about? Inequality. No one's got it better than the Maoris. Okay, bro. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, 2023. Like, okay. One of my favorite, I mean, I feel awful saying favorite because it's one of the most upsetting things that happens is when you're willing to share some of the comments on your story. It's like, it just blows my mind.
Well, I try not to do that. I do it maybe once, twice a year when there's a third. But I only, and I only
it's like
do
shit miss. Yeah.
Yeah, totally, right? And again, I do it because I find it funny. And part of me finding it funny is like, it's 2020. I think I shared one like around New Year's and I was like, let's check in on race relations. And it wasn't like even me. It was like a news story on Pacific Islanders not having like proper housing.
Yes.
It wasn't even material I'd done. I literally shared a news story on that and then just like posted everyone's comment and blocked out their names and addresses.
Yeah.
And people were like messaging me, tell us the names and addresses. I'm like, well, the story's there. But it, like, again, it's, to me, it's funny because of the date.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, and the difference between the way we talk in New Zealand, the way we're viewed internationally, and the realities, you know, and we go, what is representation? What are the statistics? And then you look at the date, to me, is always the funniest bit.
Yeah.
Especially when people like strut and are proud, like, well, I think you'll find this is Wellington. We have the first female Maori mayor we have ever had. And I'm like, oh, great job in 2022. Right?
Yeah, yeah,
like,
nice work. Congratulations. Like, it's one of the things I find most upsetting is the congratulatory nature.
The rest of New Zealand, like, oh, bloody Wellington, so woke.
Yes.
Oh, you live in a little bubble. Yeah. I was like, well, it's not that liberal a bubble, guys.
It was really funny because a friend of mine who's a Kiwi who lives in Australia, she said, all my Australian friends are saying, whoa, why did Jacinda Ardern quit? And she's like, yeah, everyone thinks we're really progressive in other places. And she's just like, we're just a little, we're not so
progressive. One of my mates called me up from London and was like, mate, how did you break Jacinda? So, and you just feel like embarrassed a little bit as well. You're like,
it's just, oh my gosh. This idea of money, I'm endlessly interested in the jobs that we value and the jobs we don't value. And I just wonder if you've got thoughts about why perhaps art is one of the jobs we don't value, if you know what I mean. Like, I spend hours annoying my friends saying, but a CEO does this, but if the rubbish isn't collected, this doesn't happen. So, I don't know if you've got any thoughts about why art falls into that bit. I don't know. It's depressing.
In one word?
Yes.
Imperialism.
Ah.
Now, imperialism, oh, God, here we go. No. Hear me out. It's the mentality of imperialism that people think. I say imperialism, they go 18th century or 19th century, and it's no. It's the mindset that comes along with coming from an empire. New Zealand, Australia, even in the States, comes from, you know, British Empire. America has its own pop culture empire.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, imperialism is about dominance.
Yeah.
So imperialism is about dominating. A part of the reason we have so many issues is because people are still in that imperial mindset. They want to be the king or the emperor, you know, who's the, want to be the greatest, got to dominate. And in that kind of society, as we've seen through history and films and, you know, art is a treasure. Art is a reward. It is not viewed as intrinsic within an imperialist society. It is a reward. It is a status. Art is something you get at the end. Whereas I think in a lot of non-imperialistic cultures, art is a form of societal expression as vital as communication. And what imperialism does is it goes, your job is not to have art or make art. Your job is to provide labor.
Yeah.
To fuel the economy that then allows us to decide through our funding who shall be patroned into the creative process. But art is a human response, so it doesn't matter what level of money is coming in. If you're artistic, you're going to express, you're going to create. Now, you might not have the opportunities, you might not have the viewers, but that's why we struggle with valuing art. Because imperialism dictates to us, the specter of imperialism in our society dictates to us that high art and low art, proper art, is patronized by the government or the wealthy. And that is the art with value. And everything else is community performance. Mm. And I think that's the heart of the issue when it comes to arts funding, is that people, we are, and I want to say that with all of that, we are moving forward in that conversation. You know, it's not like there's nothing we can do. We are doing stuff now. And part of that is through engaging in cultural dialogues. You know, thank God in New Zealand that we are multicultural, that we are, you know, we have Māori culture intrinsic to what is Aotearoa New Zealand, because the practices of the Māori culture allow us to see those gaps that we have numbed ourselves to in the rest of Western society. You know, I'm Samoan, and I can, you know, I grew up with artistic expression as a normality. And in my mother's culture and Welsh culture, there is great art there, working class art. You know, it's you know, Dylan Thomas and the choirs and the singing with the miners. But I think it's imperialism and the fact that we just don't want to engage with all that. Because it's exhausting.
Man, I've never heard it put so well. You're a genius.
No, don't.
It just makes such perfect sense to me. Like, I mean, yeah, it just, yeah. Yeah, and this idea of, yeah, that I'm just kind of mind blown, actually. Yeah, I just think it's so clear when you say it that way, and it is so, yeah, it just as you were talking, all these sort of things were coming in, and like, what I'm trying to do now is segue into rugby.
imperialism will do it.
Yeah, that'll do it, especially your podcast. Like, I mean, holy shit, like, what an amazing podcast. Like, these conversations have been happening, you know, like, I come from more a league family than a rugby family, and like, these why is everyone coming, you know, what is going on, we're stealing everyone. And I just wonder, I don't know, like, this is a very clumsy segue, but I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about Fair Game. Like, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess the tag for Fair Game is Pacific Rugby Against the World. In summary, it's about the relationship between the Pacific nations and world rugby. So, you know, New Zealand is in there, of course, because of the massive diaspora and rugby history and the interactions between the Pacific nations and New Zealand's rugby history. And it's funny because the 6 episodes, and primarily looking at Samoa, Tonga and Fiji, and the responses have all been quite telling, and also explain why we made the show. Because for the Pacific community, a lot of it is it's old news, but it's validation, and it's official. It's Radio New Zealand. It's Pacific Media Network. It's authenticity. You know, it's all the whispers. It's all of the club room conversations, the garage conversations, the lounge conversations about, hey, we're doing this. We've said, yeah, you're not crazy.
Yeah.
You know, and here's the proof. So you were right, and here it is. That's for Pacific people. For non-Pacific people in, say, Europe, you know, in England and France, it's, you know, oh, so this is what's happening. You know, we knew it was rough, but we didn't know how rough. You know, we always wondered why they struggled. Oh, that's why there's so many players, you know. So we're able to educate. Now, for your New Zealand and Australian, and much more New Zealand than Australian because rugby's not as big a sport in Australia. Yeah. It's about, yeah. I think it's number five.
Wow.
Out of this, what they got? Cricket, Aussie rules, basketball, tennis, surf lifesaving, and then I think maybe rugby.
Wow.
That's why they struggle so much. And so for New Zealand, they're like, oh, yeah, but we knew that. And we're like, yeah.
And?
Oh, it's just the way it is. And that's interesting. And that's not everyone, yeah. but those have been very interesting responses of like, or why are you being ungrateful?
Oh, my Lord.
Look at what, you know, and that is imperialism.
Hmm.
Though Kiwis wouldn't recognize it because yeah. no Kiwi would think of themselves as being imperial towards the Pacific. Mm, and that's what I mean about like the ghost of the word. You know, it says, where does that attitude come from, mate? Where does treating people like that come from? And, you know, again, I find it funny that I'm doing this show.
Mm.
You know, I'm interviewing Bill Beaumont, the chairman of World Rugby,
yeah.
and somehow I get him to open up by telling him about how I died on stage in Northern comedy clubs, but for like a few months, and then I figured it out, and then we had a great time. And he was like, oh, well, this guy knows where I'm from. That's exactly what happens. You know, he's been to those comedy clubs. He's seen someone die and then seen them a few months later killing it.
Yeah.
Like, and talking to Pacific coaches, you know, I cried in front of the Samoa coach because I watched him realize in real time how much, like, Samoa was getting screwed. And then we had a very interesting emotional response from inside the series was we had a women's episode hosted by Tali Anderson.
Yeah, yeah.
She's interviewing all these female pioneers of rugby. And they're all crying, almost every interview, crying just at how hard it's been, you know, the way it's received, the abuse they get. And then I listened back on the interviews with the men, and they're talking pretty much about the same stuff, but they don't cry, they go quiet.
Yeah.
And I go, well, they would cry if they had been raised that it was okay to cry.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, and you see me smiling when I'm telling you that because tragedy plus time. I find it, I can smile with it and go, it's a bittersweet. It's a bittersweet joke, but that's the joke there. These guys would absolutely cry, but they don't have the ability to there.
Mm.
And, you know, it's, I think it's mad that everyone's going like, oh my God, we got Moana Pacifica. We got the draw. Yeah, bro, 2022 comes back to the date, 2022.
Yeah, it is such a great series and like just, I don't know, like, and your other podcasting work has been really magnificent as well. And I guess I've got, you know, yet another boring question just about what it is about podcasting that works. Like, it's a very intimate, you know, the idea of audio, the idea that it's, well, I mean, you know, with a cell phone you can listen to it, you know, like it's accessible. I don't know, like, what do you think it was about this story that made it possible to tell it? Like, is it a budgetary thing? Is it a, what do you think it is?
Partly it's a budgetary thing.
Yeah.
I think podcasts are a medium between print and television.
Oh, that's a good way of thinking of them.
So,
yeah.
You know, people won't necessarily give you the money to make a TV show of fair game, you know. They'll think you're taking a piss. You're trying to just get a free trip to the islands, you know. Like, but podcasting, you know, and multiple platforms, you can go out. It's a bit easier. It makes it easier for the funding bodies to say yes. And to a degree, it's less intimidating for getting intimate interviews because you don't have the camera in the face. People don't have to worry about how they're going to look on the camera, especially in the modern society where everyone has to think about their brand, their personal brand.
Yeah.
And so you're able to get a bit more of that intimacy, that familiarity. You can go from having a casual chat and cracking up straight into sitting down, turn things on, and within 2 minutes you can go from, you can stay in that intimacy and just record an interview. Whereas with the camera, you've got to get everything set up and all that. So speed is another thing. I think podcasts also work in telling these kind of stories, you know, whether I'm telling mental health with fried chicken or talking about, you know, the trauma of inequality, is that these quite personal things, there's a a solitude that you can have. No one has to know what you're listening to. You can just be quietly listening to the two of us talk about things that are funny or, you know, mental health. Or no one knows what you're listening to when you've got your headphones on. And so you don't have to, you know, if it's visual medium, then they can still like screen watch over and go, what are you watching? What's that? You know, but there you can just sit and listen and it's your own thing.
Because I think that it's interesting. I think that is such a good way of looking at it. And I was just thinking, like, it feels like, I'm going to call it a cheap, it's not cheap, you know, it still takes time, it still takes energy, it still takes technology, those kind of things. But there's something about it which gives you more room to test out ideas that perhaps aren't as well received in the mainstream, if you know what I mean. Like, it's a little bit more space to sort of have the unpopular opinion or to raise the difficult things. I don't know, yeah, like I think it's really interesting. And I think that solitude is so true. Like, you know, like many a time I've, you know, listened to fried chicken and been walking down the street and just had a wee, you know what I mean? Like, it's a wee, you know, wet eye moment. But like, I do think, and there's that weird community in my ears kind of thing that happens as well. You know, like I just, you know, like, I don't, yeah, I get to listen to it myself and then I'm having my own thoughts and ideas about it as well, which I think has been really great with Fair Game because, you know, like I say, like it's the sort of thing that if it was on television, I'd probably be watching it with my dad. And I think my dad has some opinions and I have some opinions and, you know, I'd be looking at it through his eyes. And, you know, like I think that's what I really love about it. I just think it's really, really great. Is there a crossover? This is such a dumb question. I'm looking at it and I'm embarrassed that I've written it down, but I'm going to ask it. I'm just going to like push through.
I'm leaving you, Pip.
I'm formulating this idea that there's a similarity between sports and comedy. I'm sorry. No, it's terrible.
I did a show years ago now called Talk a Big Game. And it was a comedy show on sports. And people kept saying to me, why are you making this show? I made it because, and it was awful. The whole premise was that everyone was tired of me talking about politics in my shows.
Yeah.
So here's an hour of sports. And then every sports joke I told was political. Because politics isn't a magical state of mind, it's just human interaction.
And that
was my point, is that you can't separate, as much as you want sports for escapism, you can't remove politics from it if it's within society. Sports and comedy are similar because we are in the modern world entertainers. And our job primarily, like I said, the currency is time. Our job is to entertain people, to give them dopamine. You know, it's I wish comedians were paid
as well.
But having cousins who are professional athletes, I am also glad that my knees are pretty strong. You know, it is a toll. And again, athletes, I get really annoyed when the arts community shits all over athletes. Partly because from a Pacific thing, we got both, you know, both come out of the same community. And I understand it's from these tropes of bullying jocks. I understand it's a backlash, but it's, again, it's 2023, you know, like the billionaires aren't jocks, you know, the guy, you know, the power isn't, they're human resources, just like the rest of us. Even, you know, I mean, Chris Rock had that brilliant joke back in the day about Shaq's rich, the white man who writes his check is wealthy. And thankfully, the billionaire world is now much more diverse, so that joke doesn't work now. But it's, you know, it's creating division where there doesn't need to be. Like, that's not – arts versus sports isn't the fight.
No.
It's not, that's not where we got only so much energy. That's not where the struggle needs to be. Arts versus sport. We're gonna write jokes, destroying those rugby players, or write a play about how shit rugby is. Okay, man, cool, you know? It's like, Well, like rugby players going to war with comedians is not.
No,
not
definitely not. I watched Hustle over the weekend, and I suddenly realised that in the sports film there's a similarity in structure to the rom-com. You know, like there's the training montage and there's the meet cute and there's the adversity and there's the, you know, and even in Hustle there's the run and through the airport at the end. And it just got me thinking about, I don't know, I think it just got me thinking because I love sport. And I really love comedy. So those two things are great together. And, yeah, I just really like them. I kind of want to ask a question about if anything surprised you about that bit that you did on the night. Like, were there laughs? I mean, this is impossible to remember because, I mean, it was ages ago. But were there laughs where you didn't expect laughs or, like, is it something that you would develop to do again or like, I don't know.
Yeah, I would develop the idea if I was going to speak on it again. I wasn't sure, in all honesty, I wasn't sure it was going to catch. So all I could do was try and keep them engaged. I was surprised by like the knowing head nods from people. Which is, again, I find quite funny because it's like, yeah, but I'm also talking about you guys.
Oh, my God. I heard that as well. Like, people were coming to me and going, isn't that great? And I was like, yeah, but us too. Like, it was like me. I mean, I won't speak for other people, but I was like, yeah, I'll gladly, when it comes to bets and they're like, do you want to pay this price or this price? I'll be like, I'm playing the lower price. You know, and I just, yeah, it was really interesting. Like, there were a few people saying to me, oh, yeah, he's got a point.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what you realize as the other thing you're talking about, like, social comedy. Like, what you have to eventually get to a point of understanding is you're not going to change the world.
No.
All right. You, no. At best, like, at best, make people laugh and then someone go, oh, he's got a point.
Yeah.
Like, but you're not... Despite how many views that YouTube story clip of your stand-up set is getting, like, you're not writing policy. Influencing. You're just entertaining people and maybe keeping an idea alive. As Billy Bragg calls it, you're energizing the activists.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of your role. I was actually surprised no one yelled out. Sometimes when I do subjects like that, someone will, I mean, I'm guessing, of course, it's the verb
crowd. It might have been the verb crowd. You know. Didn't want to look like, yeah.
Yeah, and to that degree, I had played devil's advocate with myself and prepped a couple of responses to keep things quick.
Yeah.
Like, I just went, well, what if they go this? Oh, I can do that. What if they do that? But you also can't think about that too much because otherwise you're trying to anticipate it, or you know, some comics will try and force it, and in my experience that never goes well.
No. How do you do that? Tell me the trick to do that.
To
make people yell at you.
So maybe we'll yell at you.
No, but you know, can you actually elicit a heckle?
Yeah. Look, it's emotional.
Writing it down.
No, it's emotional manipulation.
Ah.
So you raise your intensity.
Yeah.
Both physically, and in your mannerisms, in your voice, and all you do is you take them on the journey. So you rock back a little bit. You know, you go and then you know, tell me about, oh no, you're not feeling. Oh man, I'm going then. And then you just come at them and you're like, what is your problem? What are you going? Just real direct, short, sharp, angry, to the point. Your eyes go wide, you make direct eye contact. It's just continuous confrontation with intensity. Someone will snap. Someone will either snap because you're directly at them, or someone will not be able to handle the direct you're doing with someone. It's bullying an audience into it. It's a terrible thing to do, I think, unless you're doing it towards a punchline.
Yeah.
It's leading towards a pullback and reveal, like it's intensity and the enders. I remember Jan Marie gave a great advice to all of us back in the day, which was whatever you do to someone else, you have to bring back onto you.
Yeah.
So you can go hard and be an absolute asshole to someone and go, blah, blah. But you have to be the asshole at the end.
Yeah.
The joke has to be that you were being righteous, but then you're a fool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because otherwise you're just attacking someone.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've got to get your timing right, because if someone interrupts that or the rhythm breaks, then you don't get to do the pullback and reveal, and you've just been an asshole to someone. And you got to take care of that person as well. You got to like, you got to gas them up. You got to check in. You got to, you know, if they're really hurt, then you make fun of yourself a few more times. Let it go. Move on. Come back in a few minutes later. Make fun of yourself again. Look at them. Just be like, oh, see, And it again, it's just taking their hand and leading them back out. But I generally don't do that in any of my shows.
Yeah.
Occasionally on a club set, I might have to do it to energize a crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
If I'm genuinely upset with them,
yeah,
because of the way they've treated another performer.
Yeah.
Let's say I'm headlining and someone's been on and they've really abused them. I'll knowing that I'm going to do that, I'll go at them.
Mm.
But it's to highlight how ridiculous everything is.
Mm.
You just got to play the crowd in front of you. And that way it's like sport. Comedy is a lot like cricket, actually. You just got to play the pitch that's there.
Yeah.
See how it's bouncing, read it, and, you know.
I just can't you have been very generous with your time, and I just want to ask one more question. Is it that you get into a flow state, or is it that you are checking in with yourself and watching things and, like, do you know what I mean? Like, is it like a sport where you're like, I'm hitting the ball. You're not thinking, all right, I'm going to hit it with backspin and blah, blah, blah. Is there kind of a flow state that you get on stage, or is there always this other conversation kind of going on?
Everyone's different.
Yeah.
In my experience, everyone's different. For myself, I think you do get into a flow, but you also it's both. So
yeah.
You get a general flow. You feel where the audience is at. If you're locked in, if you're really nailing it, then you and the audience are connected.
It
like theater in that sense. There's like an invisible tether between you. You breathe, they breathe. And within that, you are checking in with them without letting them know.
Mm.
So, you know, you some comedians hide it with like facial jokes and that, and like, you know, they'll do something with their face, but they're also scanning the audience, making sure. And then within that, you're compartmentalizing things in your head. That's often why like comedians after a long set are quite exhausted, because they've actually just been doing a shitload of things.
Yeah.
While looking like they're just standing there calmly telling jokes. And they're actually just going, right, you're doing that. Okay, so we'll go to you doing that. And because some of the best jokes come from an unexpected crowd interaction. You know, some of the best lines come from when a comedian has been walking across, looking right out into the far side of the audience, and then suddenly as they're walking past, just points down at someone in the front row and goes, he's on his phone. Like, you know, they've got to that point, if they're a good comic, before they've got to that point, they've already figured out a bit of what they're going to do. They're not just reacting in the moment. And again, that's for me. Some comics, and I know, like, I'll as an example, Ross Noble, an incredible in the moment improviser, but also a lot of people don't realize an incredible prepper as well. So his entire hour is like a giant spider web, and he can jump from subject to subject while also leaving space to improvise.
You must find writing so easy.
No, not at all.
But I'm just thinking, it just feels like writing's like this linear thing where the audience is an imagined kind of abstract. But
it's the writing is constant, but it's writing for a purpose. It's writing to make people laugh.
Yeah, true.
If all they had to do was get up there and like sermonize people on a subject of the week.
Yeah.
What I find helps with comedy writing is diversifying. So because I can split all of my different emotional responses into podcasting and column writing and, you know, interviews, it means that when I get on stage, I can be at my most joyful. I can, you know, I can be at my most fun.
Oh my God. That is so good. You're a genius. My God, that
I'm
is
never
such
doing
a
this
good
podcast again. You can't keep calling me a
oh,
James.
Okay. Well, yeah. You're amazing.
Do you know? The funny thing is, I'm not. I'm working class, and I have, and I speak with a certain accent the way I am because my mother was raised to code switch with class, and my father was raised to code switch with culture. Mm. So I'm very good at presenting. I think I can do upper middle class. I can do that pretty decently, but I've got immigrant working class work rate and the mentality towards that, and I can channel that. I know geniuses. Mm. I know actual comedic geniuses, and I think one of the great things is to understand when you're not a genius.
Yeah, true.
And to know that that's okay. Mm. Because you can still have fun and have a career and have joy in it. And I don't know about you, I love being in a room and not being the smartest person. It's so stimulating.
I never want to be the smartest person.
No. That's why when you call me a genius, I'm like, no, please. I'm assuming you're the smartest person here. Please.
I always remember a teacher saying to me once, a writing teacher saying, you have no natural talent, but you'll work hard. And it was the best thing anyone could have said. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I'm happy to work hard.
Yeah.
I'm very happy to work hard. And yeah, I don't know. Thank you so much, James. This has been amazing talking to you.
Thanks, Pip. It's so lovely to just hang out with you.
Yeah, it's really lovely. Okay. I'm gonna say goodbye now so that you can go and party.
Yeah, that's what I do.
Yeah, we're all party animals. Thank you so much.
I can't afford to party. Weren't you paying attention?
There's
no money.
That's right. There's no money to party. There's no money left to party.
Genius my ass.